ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, welcome to The Mindfield, where we try to negotiate the ethical, moral dilemmas of modern life. We try to make the familiar strange and the strange familiar. I can't remember if there are any other catchphrases or mottos we're meant to use, but that's all that comes to mind at the moment. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my handsomely paid co-host. Hello, Scott. How are you?
Hey. That was supposed to be just between us.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't send me your tax returns if you don't want me to.
Yeah, true.
We are talking about money today. We're not talking about money in the context of broadcasting, although I suppose that could be a show, couldn't it? But we are talking about money in the context of politics. I feel like we're at a really interesting juncture in relation to this. So I'm going to say, what is this? The intersection of a series of things or phenomena, perhaps we call them dynamics. So, the increase of a populist mood, shall we put it? A kind of thoroughgoing disillusionment with politics that is not merely Australian. We're seeing this across liberal democracies all over the place. We're seeing it even within the context. I mean, I think we sometimes think of this as a right-wing phenomenon, and we talk about Trump and we talk about Farage and we talk about Hansen and so on. But we're seeing it play out in really vigorous, full-throated ways within the Democrat primary process at the moment in the United States, for example. So it's clearly happening on the progressive side of politics as well. So we have that happening. We have a set of rules that seem to govern liberal democracy, and liberal democracy kind of ends up being distilled to rules in a lot of ways. But those rules seem to be creaking. And then we have a series of events or news stories, whatever you want to call them, that seem to show where those rules pull up short of something. And I'm thinking of most recently in Australian politics, where you suddenly had Pauline Hanson and Anthony Albanese and Angus Taylor, if not all at once, then within a handful of days, all being in headlines for stories that involve payments from people for things or potential payments that, I mean, in Angus Taylor's case, he says it didn't happen at all, but they are being approached for it. All these sorts of things. Just this connection between money and politics that I think we can call discomforting and perhaps something that goes to the heart of the discontent that people feel about politics. But weirdly, that doesn't seem to bother populists that benefit from that discontent in quite the same way. So that's the news-based context in which we're having this conversation, but it is far from a new conversation, this, isn't it?
Look, it really is. Before we go back to just how deep this particular hole goes, it is interesting, though, to point out or to tease out ever so slightly the particular relationship between populist discontent, a kind of renewed populist vigor, and charges of corruption. I mean, one of the really strange aspects, I think, of the populist message is that politics as such is corrupt. Do you want the corruption to be for your favor, to be in your interests? Do you want someone who is going to be able to use the system against itself and for you? Or do you want someone who is more concerned with simply, merely lining their own pockets in the interests of or with the appearance of political propriety? That's why, you know, it's been remarkable, hasn't it, that you take two of the most prominent far-right leaders in the UK and France, Nigel Farage, Marine Le Pen, both credibly charged, one of them, in fact, convicted with embezzling EU funds, the other with all sorts of swirling allegations and revelations of impropriety in the form of donations, possibly even being used as a mechanism for money laundering. that seem not to have dissuaded many of their voters from supporting them.
And Farage is a complicated
Farage is a really complicated, isn't he?
I mean, he has seen fit to resign from the parliament and then recontest.
That's right. And to place himself then. Oh, but incidentally, though, Marine Le Pen is doing exactly the same thing. She's using this, what is effectively a legal loophole to say that the people will be my judge.
By the way, do we need to do a show on Count Binface?
Oh, my goodness.
That would be interesting.
It is extraordinary.
I don't quite know how to approach that. Anyway, that was a thought bubble that shouldn't have got out.
If you want to know what Count Binface is, just put it into your search engine. It won't take you very long to discover. It is a kind of extraordinary moment in UK politics. It'll be interesting to see where that goes.
It symbolizes one of the most glorious things about British politics until it gets serious. Then it's like, hang on, what do I think about this? Anyway, but I think your point is broadly right, and no one distills this, I think, better than Donald Trump. It doesn't matter what scandals are thrown at him, what impeachment procedures are underway, what convictions, even felony convictions. Now, we've discussed those things on the show before, and each instance is kind of complicated, especially in Trump's case, because of what feels, at least to his support base, and he definitely makes this argument, like politically motivated use of the law rather than a sort of sober application.
Yeah, that's right.
Long-lasting and important principles. But nonetheless, however you want to frame it, he's definitely a great survivor of these sorts of things. We've had Teflon leaders before, but I don't think we've ever had Teflon leaders in an environment where quite so much muck is being thrown onto the Teflon pan, if you like. There's something about the immunity is too strong a word, but the sort of the air gap that they seem to have between the idea of scandal and corruption and then paying an electoral price, which does not apply to the establishment.
No, that's right. And look, here I think we really need to drill down on this specific point. When people lose faith in the capacity of politics to govern, to behave, to make laws and to enforce them impartially, in other words, to behave according to the norms and rules of justice, the consequences for the conditions in which democracy itself operates are catastrophic. When faith has been lost, it tends not to give rise to a new wave of successive reformers who want to champion new forms of high-level political propriety. The effect instead seems to be, if this is the swamp, if this is the sty, Do you want someone who knows how to work it, who knows how to use it, who knows where the bodies are buried, where the money is cashed, where the envelopes are being handed out? Do you want someone who knows how the system works and is able to use it for your advantage? Or do you want someone who is going to merely posture, who's going to use all of the proper pretenses of political propriety under the aegis of norm following or a no longer sustainable state status quo, but will nonetheless themselves be profiting from elite partnerships, from forms of discrete donation, and so on. And so, you know, this is, and again, pardon me for doing this, Waleed, but this is something that goes all the way back to Aristotle, as so many things that are good in this world do. because Aristotle recognized that because political representation, and he's dealing with a very limited form of political representation, I think we can acknowledge that, but because political representation works in certain discrete spheres, and it works in certain rarefied aspects of the life of the city or of the nation or of the nation state, there are forms of invisibility in which corruption and suspicion can thrive. And once those forms of corruption and suspicion can thrive, then the effect, even when it's been weeded out, even when it doesn't happen, the effect of the mere suspicion can be such that the people themselves will give way to a kind of collapse in confidence in the possibilities of conditions of justice and can then lose faith in the very people who have been elected or appointed or otherwise chosen to behave on their behalf. And Aristotle was so, I think, acute in the way that he recognized that for political leaders, there's a very particular conjunction that tends to take place. On the one hand, politicians do, or those who govern us, lawmakers, let's call them, they do pursue a certain degree of publicity. They want to be acknowledged. They want to receive something in the form of honor that money itself cannot buy. And so Aristotle uses a term which broadly means ambition, but really what it is the love of honor, the love of a certain reputation, the desire to do something for the public, to behave in the public good. And what the person who then pursues that, what they receive in turn, is public adulation. They receive reputation. But then when that love of honor is combined with something far more nefarious, something far more corrosive, namely the love of money, let's call it avarice, let's call it greed. When those two things conjoin, and what appears to be mere ambition is then underwritten by something far deeper, like the desire for profit, the desire for power, the desire for undue influence, then the one tends to so thoroughly corrupt the other that even the ability of the people to accord due honor onto public figures is itself destroyed. And that's why Aristotle, you know, right back in his Politics, which remains for me one of the most, I think, instructive and salutary pieces on the virtues that undergird the conditions of political life, he says that the only way really of rectifying this nefarious conjunction between ambition and avarice, between love of honor and love of money, is rigorous forms of accountability. But without accountability, without a certain degree of transparency, without those who occupy these positions being held rigorously and almost ritually to account, then there is no way for people to give themselves over to the kind of confidence in the possibilities of justice that our shared, our common political life depends on.
All of that I take. There is, however, there's a wrinkle in this, in that the cases that we're talking about in Australia, are they cases of corruption? They don't seem at all to be cases of rule breaking.
By corruption, by the way, you're meaning something like criminality?
Well, what do we mean by corruption? So I sort of gestured before this idea that liberal democracy really just boils down to rules. You could add norms as well. But what I mean by that is,
I would like to include norms. Because norms also, I do think, don't just refer to codes or superficial behavior. It does also refer to virtue, I believe.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that I think is so instructive about a figure like Donald Trump is he's all rules, no norms. Mm-hmm. And even rules, he'll challenge. But he has to be pulled in line by rules. He will not be pulled in line by norms. Right? It takes a court to step in and say, you're not allowed, it's illegal for you to do this. You don't have the power to do this. And that's where the limit is, not, you know, it's unpresidential for you to behave this way or whatever it is. But what I mean by that when I'm talking about liberal democracy is it's largely a procedural form of politics. Because, you know, liberalism by its nature vacates questions to do with what constitutes the good life, what objective moral standards do we live by and appeal to? It's politics that doesn't engage in those questions quite deliberately. It very quickly, and I think this is true at a theoretical level, it's certainly become true at a practical level, that it quickly becomes a procedural form of politics. It wants to manage all these interminable disagreements we might have in diverse societies over those questions by a set of rules. A way of going about things, procedures that will allow us to come out the other end. What that means is an issue like corruption is very difficult to put your finger on as a moral matter. You can't very easily say, that's corrupt, where there is no rule that has been broken, where the procedures haven't been violated. And I think a week like we had sort of shows this strange situation that we find ourselves in liberal democracies where people might look at it and go, and I think people probably did look at it. It's hard to say. I don't have polling on it, but that was just my sense. I'll put it no higher than that. and go, something about this doesn't feel right. But there are no rules broken. In the case of Pauline Hanson, she's been open about it. She's declared all this stuff. Gina paid for this and I paid for that, and that's that. You know, she's, her party, I should say, has received a donation of a plane.
Mm-hmm.
She turns this into a virtue. The virtue is, well, it's not taxpayer money. I'm not wasting your money.
Yeah. It is a really interesting defense, by the way.
It's a very, and I think for coming from her to an audience that is sympathetic to her, I think it's a convincing defense.
Yeah,
it's true. But it skips over the question of influence. Mm-hmm. Well, hang on, if you're getting these gifts and, you know, the X is paying for Y and all this sort of stuff, then to what extent are you simply doing their bidding rather than ours? And I suppose that contradiction holds. It doesn't cause any ructions as long as enough people believe that the populist claim, that is, I'm in this for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking for the ordinary person. In that case, who cares where the money comes from as long as I'm speaking for you? And then it's just a matter of whether or not you believe that. Whereas in the case of the establishment, that just doesn't flow. I mean, can you imagine if Anthony Albanese or Angus Taylor was gifted a private plane from... I just can't imagine what the popular response in the news cycle would be there. But to come back to the point I was making, these are not straight up and down cases of breaches. They're probably not breaches. I don't see a case for a breach in the case of Angus Taylor, at least nothing that's been proven. Someone would have to do a huge amount of digging, but in some ways he has the least of a case to answer among the three from what happened last week. Anthony Albanese, well, it's a fundraiser, and there are questions over who threw the fundraiser and the family that threw the fundraiser for him. And so, okay. But there's no breach there. I suppose what I'm asking is, at what point does liberal democracy in general and the public in a country like ours, what point do they have the political or the moral technology to point to something and say, that's unacceptable?
Yeah.
And then there's a separate question, which is about to what extent do they want to? So I mentioned that the establishment is held to this account, that the populists are not. I do think that's true, especially right now. But then I also think of cases like Gladys Berejiklian, former New South Wales Premier, who ends up leaving office as a result of revelations that end up going to ICAC. ICAC is a very active part in this, by the way. We can have a whole conversation about ICAC and the NAC as well at the federal level. It's interesting things to be said there. But she remains a hugely popular figure. She leaves as a popular figure. It doesn't seem to damage her pop. There's a sense. You tell me if you think I'm wrong. New South Welsh listeners, you tell me if you think I'm wrong. But my sense is that the public, when Gladys Berejiklian left office, was their response was more like, oh, does she have to? Not, well, this is a major problem and political integrity is on the line. And so there are these weird currents and countercurrents going on, aren't there? There's a sense that we want integrity, want corruption stamped out. Then there's a sense that if we quite like the leader, yeah, it doesn't really matter so much. Then there's a sense that, well, they're all corrupt anyway. Then there's a sense that this is why people have lost faith in politics, because we've had it with things like money influencing and corruption and so on and so forth, and therefore we have the populist surge. But then we don't hold the populace to the same standard. And so in the end, I think we end up with a bit of a morass. We're actually not very clear on what corruption is, how much we care about it, what should be done about it. And that's before we even get to questions to do with, well, if we don't like the influence of money in politics, whether you want to call it corruption or not, what's the alternative that we're proposing?
Good.
Are we prepared to put significant amounts of taxpayer dollars into running the system? Because people tend not to like taxpayer dollars being spent on, well, a lot of things, but especially going to politicians to run their political campaigns. We're seeing an experiment with that in South Australia. I just look at this in the end and I begin with a kind of a fire within me. It's too strong a word maybe, but with this sort of sense of urgency that there is something here to be addressed. And then by the time I get to the end of it, I go, do we want to address it? And do we have any idea about how we would even go about it?
Okay.
And I end up in a situation where all I see is grey. Not just on behalf of the practitioners of politics, but even on the electorates that are disillusioned with it.
Good. Look, I really want to get to our guest in just a second because I've learned so much from her on this specific topic. If you don't mind, though, I would like to respond just to two brief things.
Yeah.
It is interesting to me that we do, of course, both have mechanisms and ways of identifying overt criminality, forms of corruption that do transgress laws and are punished accordingly. In your state of Victoria, there are all sorts of processes that are that have already felled a premier and that will almost certainly lead, well, will they almost certainly lead to a royal commission? We'll see.
Well, there is a royal commission. They've announced a royal commission.
They've announced a royal, but that'll be after the state election.
Well, yeah. Look, if Labor loses the election, there'll definitely be a royal commission.
Okay, right. Okay, fair enough.
I think but interestingly, you're not in those cases talking about matters that the where the police have unearthed criminality and charged people.
Yeah.
In fact, that was one of the tensions in Victorian politics was the government was saying, well, we've got police for this and so on. And the police were saying, well, this is not in our field. We don't have the powers. We're not talking about things that come into, and that's why the Royal Commission calls ramped up in the way that they did.
That's right.
Yeah.
But there is this whole thing that's sometimes referred to as grey corruption. In other words, it doesn't quite transgress the rules, but it does something to damage public faith in the capacity of politics to be fair, to be just, to be equitable, and to serve the common good. And it's those forms of grey corruption where you're right. It's not that anything improper per se has been done according to either existing laws or prevailing norms, but something has been done to so damage the capacity of the public to have faith in the capacity of leaders to represent them fairly and not to be swayed by undue influence borne on the back of funds, of money, of donations, whether declared or not. I mean, that's one of the things I'm just saying not because that's what the ICAC in New South Wales is currently looking at, illegal donations that are hidden behind salaries and so on. Now, I'm not quite with you, Willie, that the public kind of sees that and more or less shrugs.
Sees what?
Sees grey corruption and kind of shrugs. There may be a growing constituency, hence our growing attraction to certain forms of burn-it-all-down populist politics. There may be a certain degree of pervasive distrust or a lack of faith in the capacity of democratic politics really to serve the common good, really to avoid, to eschew the influence of big donors. But I don't think we respond to that in a way that is unmoved, nonplussed, that's largely grey.
Well, my point is it depends who's doing it.
Okay.
So how do you explain the Berejiklian example?
That may well be something that where she has benefited from the ebbs and the flows of the attention economy. So I'm...
But even so, if what you're saying is true, as in always true...
No, I don't think always true.
Okay, well, maybe we're agreeing then. But let me finish the thought anyway. Mm. But if what you're saying is true, then the mere fact that it got to the point that it got by the time that she resigned would have soured the public's relationship with her. And it didn't. As far as I can tell, there was no sign of that.
Yeah. And look, that's where the reputation that she did have was as a conscientious premier who really was serving the well-being of New South Wales, of Sydney Sanders in particular, through any number of things, both her relationship to her predecessor, the large infrastructure projects she embarked on. You know, there may well have been a very high reputational mark that she had achieved, which then insulated her to a degree from that immediate public opprobrium. But I think the point is, you know, not least because Australia is mercifully, blessedly immune from the eye-watering sums of money that are poured in the form of donations to super PACs, for instance, in places like the United States. We are immune from those sorts of sums, even the sums of money that were purportedly raised at the Prime Minister's fundraiser, the fundraiser he attended at Point Piper. You know, in terms of what other politicians tend to enjoy in other places in the world, those are some very, very modest funds. I like the fact that when it comes to fundraising, Australians do still have quite a low expectation for the amount of money that then gets poured into political parties, not politicians' coffers, but into political parties. That's an important point we're going to have to come back to, I think. So,
And applies to the One Nation plane.
Yes, yes, true. Mm. So I do think there is still a kind of intolerance, a popular intolerance, that if you are in this for yourself, if you aren't looking after your constituency, this is where electorate, not just electoral, but electorate politics, still, I think, is just very, very, very important here.
Okay, but take the Anthony Albanese fundraiser.
Yeah.
There's no sense of him profiting from that.
No, there personally is not. But there are concerns about proximity, about undue influence, and about payment for access.
Right, which doesn't apply to the One Nation plane.
Not necessarily, no.
Why not?
Well, sorry, who it is that is donating the plane is clear. The extent of what that influence may be is not, or has been denied, or is so transparently obvious that no one really sees fit to call it into question. It's the whole issue of non-transparency in fundraisers.
So openly grey corruption, or if you don't want to use that term here...
Open influence.
Open influence that is by its nature undemocratic is fine.
Is more acceptable to more people than things that are done non-transparently, yes. I'm not saying fine. Mm. I'm not saying fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think Australians have a lower tolerance for the idea that people have paid to gain access, to gain influence, to which the rest of us are not entitled. This is where I think the egalitarian streak remains rich, remains thick, and remain strong. Just the only other point that I wanted to make, you know, you raised the issue of South Australia before.
Yeah.
They have banned private donations.
Yes.
The funding that politicians and political parties receive are public funds.
Mm. According to a formula that has to do with their performance.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Has angered some minor parties because they're saying, well, you're just entrenching the...
Sure.
Duopoly.
And look, yeah. There are real concerns that what this does is it benefits the major parties. It creates a kind of cartel where some are consolidated in positions of influence and power, and other political upstarts, other insurgent movements are left out. But I think what is really interesting there is, you know, as a proposal for South Australian voters, and this goes back to your point about Pauline Hanson's claim, well, taxpayers did not pay for my trip to wherever. This move does seem to be broadly popular among South Australians. And the rationale that was given was to eliminate undue influence and possibilities of corruption within the systems and structures of democratic politics and deliberation. I think, Waleed, there is something there that is genuinely instructive. Whether money can and should, whether donations can and should be regarded by voters as forms of political communication and influence in between elections, or whether elections, for want of a better term, are the only democratic game in town. There's something there that I find genuinely interesting, because one of the rationales that's been made, one of the forms of reasoning that's been made in other places, is that there is a strange network of forms of political communication that some voters can have recourse to in between elections. These may be in the form of by-elections. These may be in the form of opinion polls. These are various ways that voters can send messages to politicians that they're doing a good job, or that there are broad levels of discontent or frustration. I think the question is, are donations funding particular causes, or trying to place pressure in the form of withholding donations or giving donations, is that a form of worthwhile or meaningful political communication in between elections that simply resorting to then public funds that maybe are a little less responsive to voter concern, mm-hmm. to voter demand. Is that something that is being done away with in the South Australian context? Or is the gain that is made by rooting out undue influence, by trying to limit non-transparent donations, is that worth the price, worth the cost of perhaps slightly diminished political responsiveness?
Yeah, you see this turn up in American jurisprudence, don't you, where
you do.
Political donations are regarded as speech.
That's right.
And therefore you have all sorts of free speech, First Amendment sort of arguments that surround it. All right, let's get to our guest, shall we? You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National, a show that, well, I don't know what it does for you, but we hope it helps negotiate ethical dilemmas and navigate unacknowledged complicities of modern life. That was another phrase that we used at one point, wasn't it? Mm. Well, Lee Daly is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. And now, Scott, we have a guest.
Our guest is Yifui Ng. She's an associate professor of law at Monash University. She specializes in areas of public law and political integrity. She's the author most recently of Combating the Code, Regulated Automated Government Decision-Making in Comparative Context. Yifui, welcome to The Minefield.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Have we said anything that is remotely insightful?
Oh, lots of things. I'm like just galvanized now. I think it's worth first talking about why we should regulate money in politics. And then I want to dig deeper into this idea of corruption and grey corruption. So first of all, any regulation of money in politics has to balance two main competing interests. First, as Scott said, there's the freedom of individuals and corporations to express their political preferences, including giving money to the political parties that they support. Indeed, the Australian Constitution protects the implied freedom of political communication. So any schemes, including political finance legislation that infringes those principles, will be struck down as unlawful. Most recently, we saw that with the Victorian donations scheme, which was struck down by the High Court, and then they amended it to hopefully be more lawful, and then it's put back up again.
It might be worth you explaining that scheme.
Right,
people,
yeah. So basically the scheme that they put into place was actually really quite robust. It had low donations caps and bans on donations from foreign parties and entities. And so it was pretty robust compared to a lot of other jurisdictions. Other places like New South Wales and Queensland also have robust regulation of donations. One failing of the Victorian system is that it doesn't cap expenditure. Mm. So the parties can spend as much as they want. The sort of war chest campaigning is encouraged if you don't limit expenditure as well. So for instance, in New South Wales, they limit both the amount of donations and the amount the political parties can spend. The problem with the Victorian legislation centered on this tiny little part of the law that was called the nominated entities, where they allowed the major parties to introduce nominated entities that could receive donations that were basically uncapped. And they had a cutoff date that stopped all the other new parties from setting up these entities as well. So it's what was mentioned earlier, it creates an unlevel playing field between the political parties. And so that part was unlawful, but the High Court said we couldn't separate this tiny part, so we struck down the whole scheme.
Right.
But now they fixed that part, hopefully. I'm sure we'll be challenged again. And they've put up the system. So for a few months, Victoria had no donations rules. So people are like, oh, and the VEC website, they took down the donations disclosure page. So yeah, it was a bit of a vacuum for a few months, but now it's fixed again, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's one aspect that with money, we can communicate our political preferences. But there's the counter argument to that idea that we talked about, that pernicious influence of money in politics. So the key here is whether large political donations secure greater access and influence to politicians than ordinary people on the street have. And another question is whether it encourages politicians to bestow illegitimate favors or adopt policies that directly benefit donors. We talked about Donald Trump. When he was a presidential candidate, he actually said that, I gave to many people before this. Before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. And when they call, I give. And you know what? When I want something from them 2 or 3 years later, I call them and they are there for me. Mm. That's a broken system. So even Trump suggests that this money in politics can be used to gain access and influence, and it's not a fair system.
You know what's interesting, though, is with Donald Trump specifically, at the same time as he says that, he seems quite happy to defend the idea of personal enrichment.
Yeah.
So through the office. So it was the New York Times recently reported that, was it his first year of this term? He's made $2.2 billion US dollars when he was given the plane. Now, I should be careful here. The plane, Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, the plane is a gift to the US, not to Trump personally.
The original reporting was that this was a gift to the US that upon Trump's departure from office would then be bequeathed to the Trump Library.
Right. That's right. Yes, yes.
There is therefore a gray area, and the current claim is that he intends to continue to use it in his post-presidential career.
Actually, whoever it's a gift to, there are problems surrounding it.
Okay,
but it's interesting because his reaction to that was very similar to his reaction about, you know, not paying tax. It's like, well, yeah, you'd be an idiot not to accept this. What are you talking
only
about?
Only a chump, I think. Only a chump would pay tax. Only a chump would refuse a gift like that.
So he, if you put his statements together, and I don't know if this is ever wise to do with Trump because his statements vary a lot, but let's do it for the... If you put his statements together, being able to pay a politician for access so that you can get a politician to act in your interests, that's bad. But as a politician being personally enriched through your office, fine.
Or
is it just a different theory? As long as I'm being personally enriched but not being influenced politically, play on. It's, you know, this is a fair way of doing politics.
I guess the perception is also important, not just the sort of actuality of corruption or undue influence, but if the public sees you accepting a private jet and so forth, that's also corrodes democracy, as we talked about before, you know, the decline in public faith in our politicians and institutions, that's corrosive to our democracy. So even if someone is not personally swayed for the donor, the public can see what is happening, and the public loses trust in our system and our democracy as a whole. Yeah, so there are a few main purposes in regulating money in politics, and one is that corruption issue that we talked about, that we want to prevent corrupt behavior by public officials. And there are a few types of corruption that was mentioned before. So the most obvious is the quid pro quo corruption.
Yeah.
So you... the property developer gives money to the minister and then their development is approved. So that's quid pro quo corruption. You give and you get something in return. And the other element is that grey corruption that Scott was talking about before, that idea of clientelism is what the High Court called it in McCloy, risk of undue influence, the risk that politicians will make decisions based on the wishes of their donors rather than merit-based decisions in the public interest. So that's one of the reasons we should regulate money in politics. The second purpose is a broader notion of political equality, that is, there's fairness in government policymaking and decision-making, that is not skewed towards those who have the largest wallets or the rich miners or the property developers who have money to throw to the politician, and that we reduce this incidence of secret donations by vested interests and reduce the risk of regulatory capture by the government. And this prevention of corruption and increase of transparency then leads to the third purpose, that it increases the quality of government decision-making and policy-making, and ensures that government decisions are made in accordance to merit and not skewed towards these narrow sectional interests. And that will in turn, as we said, increase the public confidence in the integrity of our political institutions.
There's a lot there that's interesting. I mean, the last limb of that I think is fascinating. Why do we presume that it will create better decisions? Say, for example, you are minded to think that populist politics doesn't create better policy decisions. If you remove the influence of money, you might still be left with populism. That is, there are all sorts of other things that go into bad political decision making, some of which is to do with the media cycle, the information ecosystem, the way in which certain policies sound when reduced to a soundbite as opposed to other ones, and so on and so forth. I mean, I instinctively agree with the premise that if you don't have the taint of money deciding things, then you are liberated to make better decisions. But there is something of an overstatement or perhaps even a fiction about that, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm not saying that if you remove the influence of money and politics will suddenly be in a nirvana where everything is wonderful and great. But it's just that idea that we're trying to prevent certain elements of corruption and undue influence by more closely regulating it. And there are a few ways of doing that. The first is what we call the transparency measures. You have to disclose your donations above a small threshold, like so people know who's donating, how much they're donating, and then we can get a better understanding of what's going on. The second is what we've seen in some of the jurisdictions in Australia, regulating the flow of money into politics. So the supply of money by donation caps or bans on donations from certain sectors. So for instance, in New South Wales, Queensland and they're banned on donations from property developers, liquor, gambling, gaming industries. And the idea is that those industries have a commercial interest in donating and hoping that their licenses, their developments will be approved. And we've seen New South Wales ICAC investigations that have borne out this history of corruption linked to property developers in that state.
Can I... I've one kind of normative question for you both, and then I do have a very specific question for you, Yifui. So the normative question, let me go back to Greece. And I realize that in doing this, we are putting the fact that, especially in a place like Australia, donations are made to parties, not to politicians. There are particular platforms, if you like, that are being supported rather than individuals in particular seats. But it is striking, just sort of going back to some of Aristotle's analogies, that one of the things that, I mean, he characterized, he typified the receiving of gifts as the weighting down of one side of the scale, so that by the receiving of gifts, one's judgment is unduly weighted in a particular direction, thereby violating the very principles of equanimity and responsiveness or guidedness by justice. I guess I would like to push back just a little bit, though. I mean, obviously, just because someone isn't receiving undue influence in the form of massive donations from particular interests in society, that doesn't mean that their quality of judgment is going to thereby necessarily be improved. But let's not pretend that what goes into a political decision isn't simply that particular person's own judgment. There are all sorts of processes. There are forms of both accountability, but also deliberation, knowing that if I prescribe this, if I recommend that, if I try to legislate this, there are other factors that are going to hold that up to scrutiny, hold it to account. I guess the benefit then is by these deliberative processes, the underlying rationale is to some extent transparent and public, rather than why is it that that person is so intent on doing that when it seems so inconsistent with other things? So, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a one-to-one, non non-money influenced, therefore more politically salient and wise. But there is something, is there not, about the availability of transparent processes that ought to lead people to have a certain degree more confidence in the integrity, the sophistication.
Or does it just tilt things further in the direction of other forms of influence? So if I run a media empire, I don't need to pay you a cent. But what I can do is say, well, if you do this, then maybe I will...
Reputational damage or reputational enhancement. Yeah.
Campaigning. Yeah. And, you know, there are all sorts of other ways in which powerful actors... Media is the most obvious example. I'd have to think about others. But...
True, which is why forms of corruption in media are also well worth being brought under this anti-corruption umbrella.
Is it corruption, though? It's just my editorial line. This is just the way I feel about the world, and this is how I'm going to editorialize and make your life difficult as a government.
Yifui, what do you think?
Yeah, those are good points, and certainly there are lots of elites, I guess, with a lot of power in society, and that feeds into that public disenchantment that there's a game of mates happening in Australia. They're powerful politicians, media moguls, miners, and so forth that have a outsized influence on our policy making and government decision making. And yeah, I think that's all the more reason why we should have transparent processes in terms of money in politics, who is lobbying government as well. So regulation of lobbyists has been very poor in Australia. And there's issues of pervasive pork barreling as well. So
right.
Channeling public funds to marginal electorates. So there are a lot of flows of money and power and influence that do need to be regulated better, I think, in Australia.
The particular issue, though, that I wanted to put to you is there are some who say that the issue isn't so much either donations or the fact of donations or the amount of donations, but rather the fact that those donations can be identified as coming from very particular sources. Now, I'm not sure I agree with this. I mean, to my mind...
Sorry, what does that mean, Scott?
I'll come back to that in just a second. But to my mind, there is something you referred before to the kind of the arms race, you know, who has the biggest war chest. There's something about that. If you look at the amounts of money that are being spent, for instance, in this current election cycle in the United States, it is obscene. And you can't help... One can't help but think that there is something about the sheer amount of money that's being spent on these Senate and congressional contexts that really do activate damage to the public good. The specific point then is that there is a kind of virtue, it seems to me, in capping the amount of money that can be spent in election campaigns. The capping the amount of money, even if one doesn't necessarily say that that all should be public funds. But for instance, in parliamentary registers, you know who what the amount of the donation is, and you know who it's from. Therefore, if you want to seek similar donations in future, or if you want to secure a kind of in-kind arrangement, then you know what that person's or what that organization's interests may be. Are any of the issues surrounding corruption solved by making those donations not only limited, but also anonymous? Does anonymity simply make the money itself to a particular party communicative and white out, if you like, the particular interest that may be involved in the act of donation?
Yeah, those are very interesting points. So there are three main ways of regulating money in politics. The first, we talked about the transparency disclosure measures. The second is the supply side measures, so capping the amount of money that can be given to parties and candidates. The third is what you just mentioned, curbing the demand side, so having caps on expenditures by the parties and candidates. And we do have that in several jurisdictions
that's right.
in Australia, including New South Wales. And I think having a combination of those measures is probably the best way of regulating money in politics. In that way, we have transparency. We know who's donating, and we have people can't donate too much money to politicians. Like we saw Malcolm Turnbull donate $1.75 million a few years ago to his party when he was prime minister. So we won't have that kind of situation anymore. And for the expenditure caps, we won't have the war chest arms race to mount the most expensive campaigns because they can no longer do so.
Mm.
As to the anonymity, that is certainly an option. Then, we don't know where the money has come from, so we can't give an illegitimate favour to this person. So I think there is a possible case for that. That's, in a sense, what the South Australians have done because they've not only just banned donations entirely, but the public gets to sort of allocate their preferences to a small amount to their party that they prefer. So we have a lot of democratic experimentation across our federation, and South Australia does see itself as a democratic incubator. They've introduced truth in political advertising laws 40 years ago. They were the second in the world to enfranchise women. They introduced the secret ballot. So there's a lot happening that we could possibly, if it doesn't get struck down by the High Court, scale up if needed.
I'm very interested in the anonymity idea. What would happen if we had anonymous donations? The donations dry up. Is half the point of donating that it's known?
Having a name attached to it.
Exactly. I think there's been proposals about voucher system. So each person gets a voucher worth a certain amount that you can allocate to the party of your choice. So that's one possible way of regulating. The idea is that we want to have fewer fat cat donors, so the big rich donors, and more little kittens participating in our democracy. So, yeah.
But do you think anonymity would do it? So if all donations had to be anonymous, for example, do the mining companies say, well, there is no point me donating? Or do you think they still donate?
Well, if we have small anonymous donations, I think that would be a pretty good system. So, like,
but you could have even large anonymous donations.
Yeah, suppose if they don't know where it comes from.
Could you, though?
Why not?
Yeah.
If I don't know where the money came from, does it matter how much money it is?
Yeah, but the denomination of it gives certain indications. I think if we...
Well, no, but it's not like if a massive check turns up, I don't... I mean, there is still a range of possibilities. Don't you think?
But I'm just wondering, I think that Ifui is right that if you combine that with lowering the amount, lowering the cap, constraining how much donations can licitly be, I mean, there is something about that that makes a certain degree of sense to me. Once you're dealing with larger donations and then you impose a certain degree of anonymity on top of that, I worry that that then decreases the requisite transparency that we need for donations to be
properly
placed.
But the virtue of the anonymous donation is that it's not transparent to the recipient.
Yes, it's
now, true. Oh, who gave me this private jet? I have no idea.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, that might be right, though, right? I mean, in the case of someone like Pauline Hanson, it would be clear. But beyond that, I don't know.
There is that great episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm where both Larry David and Ted Danson donate a certain amount of money to the wing of a museum. Larry David has his name put on it, and Ted Danson just has anonymous. So he gets the virtue of doing it. He gets the virtuous reward of doing it anonymously and then tells everyone, kind of whispers to them, I'm the one that did it.
Yeah.
I do wonder if there are certain forms of whispers that then go along with these sorts.
There are ways to make it known. But also, there'd be an incentive to say you donated things you didn't. So
take credit for it. Like, it was me who donated this private jet. No, it was me. Yeah.
We're out of time, I'm afraid, Ifui, but it's a really fascinating conversation, and I think you've thrown so many things in there that, well, I certainly hadn't thought of. I imagine many of our listeners wouldn't have thought of as well, as things to chew over as a potential response to this. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the discussion. Thank you.
It's Ifui Ng, who's Associate Professor of Law at Monash University, our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield, which is now at an end. You can catch us next week on ABC Radio National or anytime on ABC Listen. We'll see you soon. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.